Hi, this is Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bendosky.
And you're listening to Start Writing.
Last month in our discussion piece, we talked about the character lie. And most of the discussion was very focused on what it is and kind of its role in the first act. And so as we go forward this week, we're going to kind of go into how that evolves in the second and third act and dealing with the dilemmas that will face the character and whatnot. And so this should capstone that. And then next month, we're planning to do a piece on a steadfast character arc. So we'll do some quick review bits right now, just so you're not in the dark. One of the things we look at with the character lie is we look at their wants and their needs, right? What do they want and versus what do they really need? And the lie is a belief that drives them towards what they want. We talked a lot about cars and Lightning McQueen last time. And so in the very beginning of the show, what he wants is to win the Piston Cup. And the belief that drives him there is that to really win it, he has to do it by himself. He doesn't really want the help of anyone. In the opening of the movie, he refuses help from his pit crew, which is part of the reason why he doesn't win the Piston Cup in the first place. But he has that idea that to really get what he wants, he's got to do it on his own. And then, of course, there is the truth, which is that, you know, with the support of his friends, he can be, you know, just do much better at everything, which is kind of the moral of the story there. And so the character lie is what drives them towards what they want, and the truth will drive them towards what they need.
That's an interesting distinction. I like it.
So anyway, one of the things we talked about last time was in different approaches in revealing the wound, which is the incident that creates the lie. We talked about the prologue, like Batman has the story of his parents getting killed, which is the prologue of pretty much any time they reboot the Batman series. That's the opening scene, right?
Yeah.
His parents are robbed and killed in front of him. And it's a prologue event. And we talked about the P.S. I Love You, where the character lie in that is the inciting incident, right? She falls in love with her husband, and then he dies of cancer, and she becomes convinced that she can't be happy anymore. And Jay had brought up the issue that isn't that kind of the same thing, this prologue versus this inciting incident. And this deals more with the arc of the story itself, right? Because the arc of the Batman story is not so much about his parents being killed. And so it's not really the inciting incident. If we look at Batman Begins, where we have that opening of his parents being killed, the inciting incident is actually when he destroys the League of Shadows, right? He's about to join them, except they want him to kill somebody, and he's not okay with it. And so he refuses to join the League, and then he has to fight them off to survive, and he saves Ra's al Ghul. And that's the inciting incident. And that's relevant because when we look at the climax, we don't go back to the person who killed his parents. We're going back to Ra's al Ghul for the climax. And so that's its relevance to the inciting incident there. And that's the difference between the prologue versus that inciting incident. Because the inciting incident is then woven throughout the entire plot of the story. And it kind of launches it. Whereas P.S. I Love You, It is an inciting incident instead of just a prologue approach, because that's what the whole story is about. So I had longer to think about it after, and so I kind of didn't want to go back and address it and go a little bit deeper there, pointing out the difference. Whereas that prologue, while it shows us the wound of the character up front, it doesn't necessarily have to be the frame that the rest of the plot is built on, right? You can take that incident from Batman and just show it and be like, okay, we understand his character and whatnot. But the whole story doesn't build around that anymore. It can build around something else. So whereas in P.S. I Love You, everything builds around that incident.
So I think you're distinguishing between something that's a matter of characterization versus a matter of plot.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah. That's okay. Way to simplify that. I spent like 5 minutes going round and round. Okay, so as we go into this, when we're establishing the lie, and developing, what you want to do is plan out key dilemmas. And we've talked about the story dilemmas in the past, right? when they have to choose between two good things, but they can only have one. When they have to choose between two things that are bad, but they have to choose. And then, of course, my favorite, when each choice has something good and something bad to it, and they have to choose one of those two, right? And so as you structure out, you can almost like schedule them out, like four distinct dilemmas dealing with the character arc and the character lie. One in the first act, which shows us the lie that they believe, right? Lightning McQueen, do you race to the finish line and try and win it, or do you stop and let the pit crew help you because your tires are wearing down, right? That's the dilemma. McQueen chooses to skip his pit crew even though they're telling him to come in and go for the finish line, right?
So in Act 1, we're showing very clearly how entrenched he is in the lie.
So there's that. So you see that first dilemma there. And like I said, then you'll get the second dilemma usually in the first half of the second act. The third dilemma comes in the second half of the second act.
This is so funny because we had a debate a while ago. I was saying that I preferred a four-act structure. And I actually have shifted. And now I think of my structures as three-act.
Really?
But I think it's funny that we keep dividing Act 2 into two parts.
Like, realistically, you'd need to because of the midpoint turn. Yeah. The midpoint turn is such a big point in a story that I tend to agree that four acts is a better description. The industry standard is three acts, so that's how you refer to it. But realistically, it's easier if you talk about it in four acts because your midpoint turn is a big deal, and that's the end of the first of half 2A. Of the second act.
We have Act 1, Act 2A, Act 2B, and Act 3.
So in Act 2, so let's talk four-act structure. So let's just say that.
Okay.
So in Act 2, you get a dilemma, and then in Act 3, you get a dilemma in Act 4. So there's a dilemma for each act that shows the character's position on the character lie versus the character truth.
So the dilemma, they just have to confront this emotional thing that they're bound to each time, and it's got to progress.
Right. So let's talk Han Solo's character arc, right? Dilemma one, he's going to get paid a lot of money by Luke and Obi-Wan, but there's a risk of the Empire, but it's not a big deal to him. It's not a big dilemma, but it's there pointing out the fact that if there's enough money involved, Han's up for anything, right? But it points out that Han's motivator is money, and he just doesn't. He doesn't care about anything else, including risk, as long as he's getting enough money, which makes sense. He's a smuggler. He's really
well, and he's also motivated by the fact that he has a bounty on him.
Right.
So there's the fear of capture and the urgency of needing to pay that off. So he's not just money grubbing. He's driven to be money grubbing.
So there's a motivator behind it. So that's Han in Act 1. So you want to think about your dilemmas as you structure. So let's go into Act 2 now, kind of looking at the kind of the second dilemma, building to it and whatnot. So in the second act, a lot of times characters will be punished for acting in accordance with their lie, right? If we go back to Scrooge, because he is so greedy, he's visited by Marley and warned. Now, it's a terrifying experience to be visited by the ghost of Marley. It's not like the ghost of Christmas Future and Present, who are actually fairly positive experience. Marley is a negative one. And so for living that lie, Scrooge is being punished by the visitation and tormenting of these ghosts, which feels like it's going to be a very terrifying experience after he encounters Marley initially.
Wait, so Marley's in the first stave, right?
Stave?
Like, the book is five staves, or kind of like five acts, right?
Yeah.
And Marley's the first one, and then the three ghosts are the next three, and then there's the conclusion. So Marley's right up front.
Marley is right up front. Yeah. So, I mean, you could say that he goes into Act 1, but I guess his appearance is kind of the inciting incident.
Yeah.
So it kind of depends on how you divide it. So
okay.
Could go either way.
Yeah.
But, and so initially, like, you know, something happens and they're punished, right? Going back to Lightning McQueen, right? He just wants to get there and ends up causing all this trouble in Radiator Springs, and he's brought into court, right? And he's told, you have to fix the road that you destroyed, right? He's punished for his selfishness initially. I actually don't have an example for Han Solo on this one. I don't think we see this part of his character arc.
So the thing that comes to mind is at the Death Star.
So
he gets offered money by Obi-Wan and takes it.
Yeah.
And then in the Death Star, Luke convinces him to go rescue the princess. And he says, there will be a reward. And he says, how much? He says, more than you can imagine or something like that.
Yeah.
So maybe that's his second, like, touching point where he...
Maybe. Because I'm actually going to talk about that a little bit later.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay.
So, anyway. So as a result of this kind of punitive event that happens for the embracing the lie, this kind of creates what is referred to as the tri-fail cycle, right? They've tried to live the lie, and for the first time, they've encountered negative consequences for these choices. And so then they try again, right? And again, you get the kickback. Now, if you're going to use this as your tri-fail cycle, this has got to be a character-based story, not just a character arc within the bigger thing, because if you're going to make this big deal out of it, right? Mm. So with Scrooge, you know, he sees something positive that contradicts his view, but then he rolls back, right? And then he meets the next ghost, and again, we see that cycle. We see the very clear tri-fail cycle with Scrooge. Mm. And then with Lightning McQueen, right, he messes the road up, and then he has to fix it, and he does a terrible job, so he can leave immediately, and they tell him, no, you got to fix it right. Yeah, you can't leave that mess out there. You know?
I got to watch this movie.
So then we have this tri-fail cycle, and usually what we have is the pattern of three, right? It's a standard in all writing, right? The first time, it could be a coincidence. When it happens twice in a row, we've established a pattern, and the third, the character changes something to get a different result, right? And so that's where you have that pattern of three there, is that two establishes that you now have a pattern. This is something that's going to continue to happen. You know, it's not just a coincidence with the first time. So, and then also within this second act, you give them a glimpse of life without the lie, right? So they see how things would be if they're not embracing this lie. So going back to Cars, he sees, what's his name? The judge was this huge winner of the Piston Cup, and the judge embraces this community life. Like, he sees this huge champion who's not all about himself, right? He sees this brief glimpse of this awesome life of someone who doesn't live that lie. And so that, you know, they've encountered punishment and they have seen a positive life without embracing the lie. Like Scrooge sees, you know, all the happiness that people experience at Christmas, right? They see this, and so it begins to kind of twist just a little bit, turn in the screw, be like, maybe, you know? So we get that first stage. And so that is in Act 2, or the first half of Act 2, depending on what structure you want to go with. 2A. Maybe 2A is the clearest way to communicate that. Right? then we get the midpoint turn for the character lie. And I think this is actually that turning point, right? So you combine the punitive with seeing the positive, right? And so... for Han Solo, who's in it just for the money, right? So Travis talked about, you know, this whole Princess Leia thing. You know, like, there are two oppositions to Han, because he just wants out. He's like, we are just getting out of here. Mm-hmm. And Luke, one, refuses to go, and two, tells him, you know, more money than you can imagine if you save this princess. But then he meets Princess Leia, and it... kind of, that's the kind of turning moment for him a little bit, because suddenly he's interested in something more than money, right? He's interested in Leia.
So I want to maybe adjust your Han Solo arc just a tad. Okay. So I might say that Act 1 is he encounters Jabba, and like you see that there's the bounty on his head, and then he gets the money from Obi-Wan. Act 2 is the part you just mentioned where Luke says, come save the princess for a reward, and he does it, and then meets her and starts a shift. And then the 2B would be when they're at the like rebel base and he's packing up his money and getting out of there. And I think maybe we see the rest of this conflict play out off screen.
Yeah.
Because we know then that the fourth part is that he comes barreling back.
Yeah, in. See, yeah.
Like he's forgot about the money and he's in it for the girl. Or the glory, or right. Something other than the money.
So, Yeah, so we'll circle back to this.
Okay.
So yeah, so the midpoint, right, is so you, in your act, in your two-A, they're punished. At the midpoint, they see a positive life of somebody living the truth as opposed to the lie they've embraced, right? And so now we go to the post-pit midpoint, to Act 2B, which is what Jay was talking about. I'm gonna try and call him Jay. He introduced himself to me as Travis. I struggle with it because that's how everything I do, except this podcast, is Travis. I told him, in the future, do not introduce yourself to people as Travis.
He's doing very good, though. He's called me Jay twice this episode, which is very good.
So that's a problem with a pen name. I guess it's not a pen name. That's like your actual
first
name.
It actually is my first name.
Yeah, but it's like a pen name J. because you always introduce yourself as I'm Travis.
That's true. So. Depends on the circle, though. So. But you're in a circle that already knew me as Travis, so.
Well, but see, like, I hadn't met you yet, but like I'd heard everyone had said, meet Travis. Yeah, He's a writer. You need to meet him.
And it's so, yeah, it's deeply ingrained in certain circles. In other circles, I've gotten out.
That's funny. Okay. So post midpoint lie. So now the character needs an opportunity to experiment on the truth, right? So they've been punished for the lie. They've seen a glimpse of life if they choose not to live the lie. And so now it's kind of like a curiosity thing. Like,
we're in 2B?
2B. Okay. Yeah, what if I act differently? And so again, you need to present to them a dilemma here, right? Again, a chance for them to make a choice. Only this time, there is something that urges them to experiment with a different way of solving this problem, right? So this is the pattern of three we just talked about. 1A, we see them, you know, doing the thing that they've always done. That's point one. In 2B, they do the thing they've always done and they're now punished for it, right? So now we have a pattern of them making that kind of choice. And now we're at choice three and they're going to do something different, hoping for a different outcome. And so this for me, I think this is the hardest of the three dilemmas to structure because you have got to set it up so that there's an incentive beyond just curiosity or it's just time for them to make that choice contradictory to the lie, right? And so that's the kind of staging that that makes it really tricky. And a lot of times the way this is end up being created is the character makes a choice because both the lie and the truth seem to be leading towards the same conclusion, right? Like Lightning McQueen hangs out and is having fun with Mater because he thinks that he can convince him to do something to let him get free. I can't remember exactly. I should have watched
it. No, I haven't seen it forever. I cannot help you out.
But, you know, but in that, he builds an actual friendship with Mater, even though there's a part of him that's just using him to try and get away.
Wait, so how is the lie pointing him toward the same thing that...
So the truth is him embracing community and depending on others, right? The lie is him not needing others and getting away and getting back to the piston cup.
But you're saying because the lie keeps failing to help him,
right?
It's now pointing him toward abandoning the lie.
And so he has to build community, but again, the end goal is still the same for him here. I guess the way to structure this best is the truth they now see as a tool to get them what they want, not what they need yet, right? What Lightning McQueen wants is to get to the piston cup. He's tried doing that by himself, and it keeps blowing up in his face. First, he gets dragged into court, and second, he does a terrible job on the road and gets into more trouble. So then he decides to use the technique of community. He goes to Mater, builds a friendship with him to try and get Mater to help him get away. But the end goal is still the same for him, get to the Piston Cup. It's not yet about actually embracing community. And so what we have here is that split, right? So we have the lie, which is directing them at what they want, and then the truth, which directs them to what they need. And so at this point, the character is now using the truth to try and get to what they want. He's trying to use community, but it's still all about the piston cup. It's not actually about the other people yet.
Okay.
Right. So like I said, I think this is, of all the dilemmas you set up, this is the trickiest one you'll encounter. Right? They kind of have a debate here. So if we go back to cars, we also have the moment where he starts to be interested in the female lawyer. I can't remember her name. But yeah, so the romantic interest now comes into play, and she's a big part of Radiator Springs. And so there's now even yet another pull of dragging him into this community here is her and his interest in her. And so in plot versus character, Jake Garrick calls this vacillation escalation. As the character acts on truth, turns back to and back and forth and back and forth until a catalyst or time forces a decision and action, right? So we see them undecided on this. The dilemma is kind of the big dramatic point that you have here, but it's good to see that character kind of unsure about that decision. And in Scrooge, you see this a lot. Like, you see him being leaning in, you know, he sees his nephew who's made, you know, this handmade gift for him, and he's, you know, like, you see him soften for a moment and then rolls back to being Scrooge, and he sees Belle and he softens a little bit and then he rolls back to being Scrooge, right? You see him vacillating back and forth here. So, and again, this culminates at the big dilemma of this part where, again, they have to make this choice, and they kind of make it half and half. They're still acting on the lie. I mean, they're acting on the truth, but they're still pursuing the goal of the lie. And so it's kind of half and half as they go.
That's sweet.
Yeah. So, and one thing to kind of think about here is the character's mindset before and after, right? Think of the problem. Are you taking notes or are you writing questions?
Sorry. I've jotted down a couple questions that I think I'll save to the end because I don't want to throw up your group.
I was like, I hope you're not taking notes on this stuff. Like, I send you the notes. So contrast your character's before and after mindsets. Think of a problem and how would they approach it while believing the lie, and think of how they would solve it after accepting the truth, right? So, you know, maybe you can set up a few dilemmas for the character and be like, okay, in the before, how would they react in the after? And, you know, you kind of find this middle ground in between for this act too. So we move into the great dilemma, which kind of bleeds into the climax here, between the thing they want and the thing they need. Like in Harry Potter, right? Like, he has grown up all alone, all by himself under those stairs. And the thing he's really wanted the most is friends, right? And he finally finds that at Hogwarts. He gets the thing he wants, right? But as he goes through the trials of the Sorcerer's Stone, one by one, he has to leave his friends behind. And so he is eventually forced to make that choice, right? The thing he wants, which is his friends, and the thing he needs, which is to stop Voldemort, right? Because that's what Harry does. Ever since he was born, that's what Harry does, right? And so each time he has to leave Ron, and he has to, you know, and they don't know if he's okay. And so, you know, it's a good climax to that point there. Which is the interesting thing about Harry Potter is it's kind of a contradictory character arc than you would expect, because usually it's all about people learning about friends and stuff. But Harry is already fully embraced in the people. What Harry needs to learn to do is embrace his destiny. So again, from Jess Garrick on The Great Dilemma, the protagonist comes to understand both the promise and price of the two ways. He comes, in other words, to truly understand his choice. The moment is not complete unless the hero understands not only what he stands to gain by choosing one option over the other, but also what he stands to lose. And I think that's a really good point. That character fully understanding what they're losing by making this choice is a powerful moment in them making that decision, right? It's not a blind choice, right? At that point, what they lose is sacrifice. It's not something taken from them. It is something they have given up. And so, you know, in Cars, it's the thing Lightning McQueen has always wanted, that piston cup.
Wait, so he chooses to
because he could win the race. But Schick has crashed King, and King is like smoking out in the middle of the field, and Lightning McQueen slams on his brakes.
He's gonna die.
So, well, I don't know if he's gonna die. He's just out there, right? He's banged up. And so Lightning McQueen slams on his brakes before he crosses the finish line, and doubles back, and he goes and he gets King and pushes him across the finish line. Right. And so in that moment, it's a very clear choice. This is the thing he has always wanted, and he gives it up.
Wow. That's pretty cool. I gotta watch the movie.
So, I mean, yeah, like Scrooge and Cars, those are like the great character arc stories. Well, because that's what they are. They're character arc stories. You know, everything else is there to support the character arc. Whereas when we look at Han Solo, it's a little more complex, right? Like one of the great dilemmas takes place off stage, right? When he's taken off with his money and he's there with Chewie, a great dilemma takes place and Han makes the choice to come back and we don't see it because it's a subplot of a sub-character in a bigger story. You know, there just wasn't screen time for that. And I like looking at Han because it's how most character arcs will play out. Either it's a subplot or it's part of a minor character's storyline, right? Mm-hmm. And
man, I just have to say, if we were to go edit the Star Wars script and see Han making that choice, I think I would love it.
Like, I do too. I think it would be a great moment.
But what we would lose is the surprise of having him show up.
I don't know. I think what you have is you see the dilemma, right? And Han debating it. And Han,
you're saying we show the debate but don't show the decision. So we can keep the surprise.
So you keep the surprise, right? Mm. You see Han struggling, right? And you see him, like just like Garrick says, fully aware of what happens in both choices, right? What happens if I just take the money and run? Like, then I'm free. No ties to Jabba, no ties to Rebellion, no Empire chasing me, no bounty hunters. I'm a free and very wealthy man, right? And if I go back, I'm going to be involved in a war and we could die. And, you know, then we're getting dragged into this rebellion, which means anywhere we go, the Empire's going to hunt us. But Luke and Leia are back there. Right. And then I would say you don't show the choice, right? You see him weigh the decisions and struggling. And in the end, you know, then we find out when he actually shows up.
Yeah.
So that's my thought on it. Because I think it's a great moment to the Han story storyline.
I agree.
You know, that third great dilemma took place off screen.
So. That's cool. Good rewrite. Let's publish it.
So in Act 3, they have embraced the truth, but they have a crisis of faith. Right? And so with Han's arc, this is not a step that we have. Right? But if we think back to Scrooge, he wakes up and for a moment he's like, it was all a dream and it meant nothing. Like, he has that brief moment where it's like, it's a dream. It's nothing.
I'm not sure that's what he thinks. Well,
right. But there's that moment that none of it was real, you know, and in that moment he kind of has that crisis of faith. He could go back to where he's always been. He doesn't actually have to change. You know, this what have I done moment. I think we've all had that moment where you've kind of gone forward with a decision and it hasn't really worked out the way you planned or whatnot. And you're like, what have I done? what mess have I gotten myself into? Right. And so that's kind of this for the character arc, right? I don't think we see this in Cars, you know. I think the climax takes place too quickly. But if you were to slow it down and expand, essentially, and it's harder in a film, I think, because in a book, you can go into the character's head and really experience their thought. But I mean, if Cars was a novel, Lightning McQueen slams on the brakes.
We could have a whole chapter right there.
Is racing towards the finish line, and McQueen has that what have I done moment. Ever since I was a little kid, you know, assuming the personification, that's what I wanted. That's it. What have I done? I just gave it up. Right? You know, and like I said, the action's a little bit too quick in the climax of Cars to really sink your teeth into the moment. But in a novel, you sink your teeth into that moment, right?
Does he ever, like, look at the cup longingly?
I should have watched this movie this week or at least this month. But, yeah. And so,
I just wonder if you were a screenwriter and facing this problem of being too hurried, how could you still squeeze that in there?
So I think the most you could do is a look, right? A single long
look. Just have a glance.
I mean, I wonder if the mic even picked that up.
That was it. The logging.
Right. I think, you know, because it's tougher without that ability to get into the character's head.
Yeah.
Okay. But as we're writers, you know, we have this what have I done moment in the character arc, this crisis of faith. And then they're like, nope, I'm going forward with this decision. Once the characters embrace the truth, they need this newfound belief to be challenged. And so this is usually the grand climax of the story. So we talked about Dream. In Cars, I guess this newfound belief to be challenged, this is a little out of order. But one of the ways it's challenged is he's given an opportunity to go race at the Piston Cup without fixing the road and without embracing community in Radiator Springs, right? The media finds him and they're ready, and they take him away before he's fixed everything. And then while he's in the truck, he has this, you know, this remorse and whatnot to go back.
Well, so he makes a choice to embrace the truth before that moment on the tracks. So he does it twice, right?
So yeah, well, because the whole book is his arc, and so he's going back and forth, and each time he edges more and more towards the truth, right? Which is what each of these kind of dilemmas is about, is the character vacillates and they're slowly pushed each time with each challenge closer and closer to the truth until the moment when they've been embraced it, and then they're given the challenge where the easy choice is the lie.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's for McQueen, when the media finds him, suddenly the easy, you know, he can go back to his life.
Okay.
And just leave Radiator Springs a mess and not care. And so, you know, even though he's now embraced community, he no longer has to, you know.
So he has the choice to choose community when the media shows up, and he doesn't choose him. But then he gets down the road and does. So,
right. Yeah. Okay. But in that moment, the easier choice, right? And so it's once your character has kind of embraced that truth, you then present the dilemma where the easy choice is to go back to who they were at the very beginning of the story. Scrooge wakes up. It could have all been a dream. And he, like, the ghosts are gone. Nobody's haunting him anymore. He can go back to being Scrooge that morning, right? Yeah. He has that option. He has made no decision in the real world that pushes him down the road. But he doesn't.
Yeah.
Right, but again, the easy choice there is to not change, right? Nobody's haunting you today. The ghosts are gone, and it could have easily been a dream. But he doesn't make that choice. He sticks with it. And then in structuring the climax of the positive arc, you want to make sure that it illustrates how they've changed. But also, you want to make that, you know, particularly if you're dealing with a character arc story, the climax and the conquering of the antagonist needs to be integral to the character arc. So Cars does this so well, right? So again, we have the race at the Piston Cup. Lightning slams on his brakes. He gets King. He brings him across the finish line, and he's given up the thing that he's always wanted. Now, here's the interesting thing, right? So Schick is the antagonist. He's always making fun of everybody. And, you know, he's rude and cruel. And he's the one who slammed his side into King and, you know, wrecked his car out on the track, right? So Schick is the antagonist. And so Schick wins the Piston Cup. But because of what Lightning McQueen does, the victory is empty. No one is celebrating Schick for his victory. All they care about is what Lightning McQueen did. And so in the final choice of the character arc, Lightning McQueen defeats Schick. Right? That character choice is the choice that beats the antagonist. And so, as a subplot, this is a little bit more challenging to do, but if you're dealing with a direct character story, like, that is a perfect climax to that character arc story, because it blends into the actual plot and showing that they have changed and become better people is how they win. Right? I mean, it's a fantastic moment in the show Cars. And, you know, you can't look for a better moment when using the character, you know, trait to win is demonstrated. So, yeah. So ideally, when you're dealing with that arc, you can, you know, try and set it up so that the character trait is then the very thing that defeats antagonist.
Man, what a cool ending.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, like, you see the movie and it's like, it's pretty good. But you dissect the movie and it's like, man, they really... really did a great job with their character arc in this story. Like, it's fantastic. It's so well done. as a character development story. It really is well done.
That's so cool.
So having studied it, I'm far more impressed with the movie.
So I gotta, I think we kind of covered this first question, but we're calling this thing the character lie, and
I was gonna say that was kind of the first one, and I guess this one is evolving the character lie, but these two episodes together are the positive character arc is what we're addressing here.
Oh, okay.
So,
So I was just thinking about Lightning McQueen's lie that he's embracing is a lie, and that's that he ought to do it on his own, right? And so he conquers that in a way by understanding truth. Whereas if we look at Han Solo, his character lie is that I need a lot of money or Jabba's gonna kill me,
right?
But it's true. And so,
well, but I think it's bigger than
and
that.
And he gets his comeuppance for ignoring that in the end of Empire Strikes Back, right?
Right.
So I think in a way, well, I don't want to say that one is better than the other, but I kind of like the fact that Han Solo's lie is kind of true and that he does pay a harsh consequence for choosing the other one.
That is interesting. I think one of the things I'll point out though is that we have that conversation on the after they've been captured about Leia, right, where he says more money than you can imagine or you can dream of, right? And so that is the point that really points out that it's more than just escaping Jabba. It is greed. Like there greed driving Han for sure, right? You know, I mean, there is this additional threat that does catch up to him eventually.
Yeah.
But I think that line of dialogue between Luke and Han illustrates there's definitely an element of greed to Han's choices, which he does overcome. And, like you said, point out, interestingly, in the next episode, comes back to haunt him because he overcomes that, right?
Well, so Harry Potter's, you set up as his lie is, well, not his lie, but his want is friends.
Well, he gives up normal, right? He wants to be normal and have friends. And it's the normal that he really can't have.
Well, but so is that emotionally untrue? Like, I just feel like it's better conflict when you have these really positive options on both sides and you're forced to sacrifice one of them. Which I feel like Harry kind of is. It's like,
yeah, I guess
you can kill Voldemort, that's really good, or you can help your friends, that's really good. Which are you going to do?
Yeah.
It's just like a really intense choice because...
Both are
yeah, it's not a lie. It's not a bad thing that he needs to get out of his mind. It really is a good thing.
Right.
And he has to let go of it.
Oh, that's a good point. That is a good point.
Anyway, I think that's an interesting concept. So. Another thought. Oh, so... As we were discussing this, I'm writing a book, and the main character I think has a really cool character lie going on throughout. But as we talk about this, I just love the concept, like of digging into the emotions and like getting so much out of a character by doing this. And so my question is, can I spread it to how many characters? I mean, I got like 9 characters in this novel. How far along those 9 characters should I spread? I mean, so surely character number 1 has it. I just said that. But
right.
And character 2 also is going to. But do I need to get all the way to character 7, like with a really good character lie?
Well, and this is one thing I read, and I thought this was a really good point. And that is that people know stories, right? You kind of know your protagonist in the end is going to pick the truth and the need, right? And so one of the things you can do to throw them off is you take some minor characters and their arcs, and they don't. They end up reverting back to the lie. And then suddenly it's like, well, I don't know. I mean, this is classic Martin, right? The difference is that with Martin, you don't feel like there's any real protagonists. I guess you've got Jon and Sansa and Arya, and those are your protagonists.
Yeah.
But, you know, other than that, you're kind of like, is it a protagonist? I don't know. And so, like, you know, and so Martin goes back and forth. And so you really never feel like you know what's coming.
Yeah.
Right? Because each character, you know, some of them end up bad, some of them get good. Some of them go half and half, you know, like Theon Greyjoy. You know, half the time he's a monster, half the time you feel bad for him.
Right? So bad.
You know, I mean, and so, you know, so leveraging these... these side characters and their own character arcs lets you throw off the audience expectation, and so you end up like you're reading George R. R. Martin, be like, I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. I don't know.
Another interesting thing. So Lightning is selfish, and I think any viewer is going to say, okay, he's selfish. That's a problem. Like, you can see where that's going.
Right.
Whereas, like, Eddard Stark in Game of Thrones, we see him essentially give up selfishness. Like, we see him make the choice that everybody intuitively knows is the right choice. And when Lightning makes that choice, we see him win the cup, essentially, right, in spirit. But when Eddard makes the same choice, he does the quote-unquote right thing, he doesn't win the cup. Like, right, he pays for it big time. So anyway, I guess maybe you're flipping what we expect as the moral outcome, like good, right, always triumph. George R. R. Martin flips that and says, you know what, it was good, didn't exactly triumph, yeah, and it hurts. But yeah, I don't know, it's just interesting.
So yeah, Martin does a lot of things where he just flips things and you know, he does, yeah, it so often, really, it just throws off your expectations. And you know, I think that is the real strength of his work. I mean, people talk about the depth of his character, but I think the best thing about Martin is you just never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you know you're going to be surprised. You know, it's just not predictable.
Man, and I love that you bring that up. So he has told the television series makers how the books play out. But I'm super excited to see how the books actually play out, because I feel almost certain if that's what he meant to do, I feel like as he writes it, it's going to be different.
It's funny.
Which I'm just excited to have that distinction. I hope that's he does. Funny. I hope he still surprises us. But
I bet he will, just because of how he writes.
Yeah, you know? It just seems like...
I mean, from what I've read of his process, we've gone off on a rant. Maybe we should close this off here and we can discuss after.
Okay.
But...
yeah. I did want to do one quick follow-up, okay, to our two times ago. And just to say that I've been using the soft timer that you mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
And it's been awesome because I don't quit because suddenly I hear the beeping. You know, yeah. I just keep going. I feel like I keep going extra long.
Right.
And it's been awesome. Good. So, good tip. Yeah, that all was right, great.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for listening to Start Writing. If you enjoy the show and want to support us, then check out Song of Locke by Jay Washburne, or check out When the Sky Falls by Joseph Bendofsky. There's actually several books by that title, so best to go by my author name. Yeah, kind of sad. I learned that after I published. We would love it if anyone would leave us a review on iTunes. That would be great.
That would be awesome, guys. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.